There was an image that we pulled from the enrollment of the widow's passage. It was the image of the church as motherly, and the importance of that as not just a motif and certainly not just a metaphor, but a virtue complex that brings a lot of those protective and nurturing features of the mature Christian life into focus. Well, now what it looks like to belong to a people of God, which as a people are motherly or called to be motherly. Motherliness as a vocation for all Christians, not just for gendered women, but for the church as a whole, called motherly in light of Christ, God's own example, Christ's example, the Apostle Paul's example, to enter into a church reality that has a motherly vocation requires certain things in order to be realized, requires certain rhythms, practices, habits of thought, habits of life in order to realize that spiritual vocation, that calling. And so what we want to do beginning today is explore what is probably the most well-known, most familiar of the distinctively Reformed commitments when it comes to spirituality, Christian spirituality. It is certainly not exclusive to the Reformed tradition, but it is something the Reformed tradition is most characteristically known for stressing. And that would be the church as a Sabbatarian people. However, the way we want to unpack that idea is likely going to be different from the way Sabbatarianism is ordinarily conceived. And we want to begin our journey on that very path by stepping back from the Sabbath question, Sabbatarian question, to say something very important about the general reality to which that belongs. When we're talking about a Sabbatarianism of heart and mind and rhythm, which will be our interest for the next several weeks, when we're talking about that, we're talking about something unique to one day of the week, the first day of the week. And when we're talking about its uniqueness, we're referring to something that is true when the church is gathered together, assembled together. In other words, we're talking about a liturgical or worship reality that is expressive of a Sabbatarian mindset and heart set, if you will, and habits and practices. The reason that is so important to remember is it helps us link the whole Sabbath question to the more general question of the relationship of worship or liturgy to pastoral care and the Christian life. It's really interesting that many of the assumptions we bring to the table from our own era, our own day, in reading biblical teaching about what the church looks like, what the church ministry looks like, that we find a lot of things that are at work in our mindset and assumptions don't find resonance in the biblical texts themselves. And these differences serve to alert us to the possible a distance between the way we think normal looks and what the scriptures appear to think normal should look like. One of those areas where there's a big difference is when we go to, especially the New Testament, but the Old as well, and we ask, what does pastoral care look like? See, when we ask that question in our context, particularly in the modern or postmodern West, or most modern West, as some would put it, when you ask that question in our context, especially in light of what we learned a couple weeks ago about the environment of moralistic therapeutic deism as the animating impulse of our culture and our time, when you ask the question, what does pastoral care look like, what are some of the things that quickly rise to the top of the list? Give me examples. What do you think? Pastoral care looks like... fill in the blank with anything that comes to mind. That's fine. Nothing. All right, you have no commitments. All right, yes.
Well,
shepherd guarding the sheep, right? Okay, that's an image, right? From John, yeah. Mm-hmm. How about the practical form of it? Yes. And the form of that becomes the question. Because there's no doubt that's deeply biblical. I have such pastoral concern for matters like that. But the form of it becomes the question. What I'm after is that there is a default expectation that pastoral care primarily looks like personal counseling. And if we assume that to be the case, then we go back to the scriptures to look at, okay, where are examples of pastors doing pastoral counseling that looks like that? Where is that in our list of qualifications? Where is that in our characterizations, our descriptions of pastoral practice? And we find none. Nothing. There's nothing there. Instead, the pastor needs to be, over and over and over again, especially equipped in the things that belong to assembled worship. He needs to be able to preach the word in and out of season, defend the faith, care for the flock of God in context of discipline and care and nurture, but again, it's with the flock as flock in view. Lead the worship of God's people, lead in prayer. These are all things that we find mentioned repeatedly in these qualification lists and in these historical descriptions of the church at work or the minister at work, but we don't find examples of the personal counseling scenario. Now, there's nothing wrong with the personal counseling scenario. It is a very legitimate way of translating shepherding to the context of the individual or the family. Nothing whatsoever illegitimate with that. But the fact that we don't have this listed and described within the biblical canon should at least give us pause about why it is the world around us thinks of that arguably first when thinking about what it looks like to be the recipient of pastoral care. Well, historically, there is a way to trace that shift, that change. And perhaps unsurprisingly at this point in our class, the shift toward a personal counseling model for pastoral care took place with the rise of a therapeutic culture. The more we, and we learned this in our first week, the more we became accustomed as a culture to identifying or defining our problem in therapeutic terms, not sin and the need of grace and the gospel, but what's happened to me and my past or how I feel about things or my makeup and things like that, to the exclusion of matters of sin and grace, the more the remedy became defined therapeutically. And if the problem and the remedy become defined therapeutically, and alongside this, you adopt a market mentality about the church, so that you treat the church not like it used to be, where in a parish situation, you went to the church in your neighborhood, but now you have, as we do in this part of Coriopolis, maybe 112 churches in the neighborhood, and you are automatically in a market mentality because you're choosing from area options, local options, a reality that was sped along, pun intended, by the rise of the automobile. Now you can get to another church if that's the one you prefer far more easily than when you were dependent on walking down paths in your village or your neighborhood. Well, when you adopt a market mentality, you choose the church you want to go to. Now the criteria for making that decision are informed by how you see the problem and its remedy. So these things end up going hand in hand. As Western culture develops more and more along the lines of therapeutic ways of looking at of our problem and our remedy, alongside a consumerist and market mentality about religion generally, Christianity specifically, well, then you choose a church and you believe a ministry qualifies as valuable by how much it's potentially going to meet your therapeutic needs. Alongside your therapist or in the place of your therapist, personal counseling now becomes the driving issue of demand in deciding on a church. Now, that's a radical shift in what the church meant and what the church was expected to do from what had been the case for 2,000 years, the better part of 2,000 years, when the church was understood, defined, expected to be something very much along the lines of what we would call its public ministry. Yes, there was obviously the faithful parson, church parson, to use George Herbert's image. There's certainly the faithful local village priest, minister, whatever. But that legitimate and valid and important personal or domestic ministry was seen on the periphery of what was central: word, sacrament, discipline in both positive and negative terms, catechesis of a body, particularly of the young people as they make their way through the story of the church and the story of their own lives, public ministry of the household of God along these lines. So you see the significance of the cultural inversion that has taken place. Now it's almost as though one has to defend the importance of word, sacrament, the ordinary means of grace, and don't even ask questions about the propriety or the relative proportion of importance for those things that used to be considered peripheral. We can push that even further and say the more the culture becomes a culture of entertainment, and that's an expression of its therapeutic impulse, now the church needs to be entertaining in order to qualify as a candidate for my investment, my personal attachment. So you see how the cultural inversion has found expression in the church's reversal from what it used to be expected to be and now what it's demanded to be expected to be. Well, one of the great tragedies of all of that is an eclipse of what it means or meant and still means to be Sabbatarian in biblical terms. And what belongs very much to that portrait is understanding the worship service and the regular assembled life of the church as itself the chief form of pastoral care. Let me put it in terms that might sound a little harsh at first, but hopefully before long won't sound very harsh at all. The point of departure and the orientation biblically, and we've seen this already in Hebrews, for the issues of sin and righteousness, the issues of need and provision, the issues of spiritual struggle and their remedy, are focused so strongly on the critical importance of the regular means of grace in public worship that if, in the case of any spiritual challenge or struggle, the first question asked biblically is whether or not we are faithful in active participation in the ordered worship services of the church every Lord's Day. If there is a no answer to that question, there are no other questions to be asked yet. Only after that is in place does it become meaningful, not just legitimate, but meaningful on Christian terms, to ask what else must maybe part of the picture as far as addressing our spiritual needs and the issues of our Christian life, and so on. That's the first question, and it is so controlling in its significance that this session in particular has made it a resolved commitment. That is the first question in any context of personal or family pastoral care and visitation and care for a particular need or a crisis of faith. The question is, are you, in fact, faithful every Lord's Day to the ordered and public services of the church where Christ has said he gives grace for our needs? If we're not there for it, then there's nothing surprising about not receiving the grace that's needed to keep us going as Christians. So simple and critical is that part of the picture, that when it's in place, then we are released to explore the particulars, the concrete dynamics and challenges and context of spiritual struggle, which are physiological, which are family, marital, spousal, children, work-related, or whatever the case may be, illness-related. But those matters of life, because they are matters of life, must begin with the center of gravity. And this is, in part, a reflection of the biblical understanding of liturgy, the ordered worship of the church, the way that it is ordered, the things included in the worship services as the Lord's, as the Good Shepherd's principal way of caring for his people, of shepherding the flock, of providing pastoral care. This is why biblically there is so much of a preoccupation when it comes to qualifications of a pastor, that he be able to do exactly that. Lead in the Lord's Day services of worship with faithful, informed, compelling preaching, informed and thoughtful prayers, leading in confession of sin and pardon, structuring the service accordingly, not because it's basically his what he does because he only works on Sundays, but because it is the center of the world, it is the center of the new creation, it is the center of every individual life, and when the center isn't in place, nothing else can be in place. And so worship as pastoral care is arguably the first lesson in Reformed and biblical spirituality. There's not a lot of bells and whistles here. It's not really fancy stuff. You don't need a self-help book for it. You don't need 12 steps or 24 steps. You need one. And it's really as simple as working on God's calendar, on God's time, believing his word about where he said you can find what you need. Now, it's because that is so central that the Sabbath question takes on a different form, a different cast than the way it is most frequently handled. Let's be clear from the outset of our series of lessons now on a Sabbatarian heart, mind, and rhythm, that what we will develop along the lines of a Sabbatarian mind, heart, and rhythm is not to be confused with the common, though bankrupt confusion on biblical and Reformed Sabbatarianism that completely collapses the New Testament Lord's Day into the fourth commandment, as though they are exactly identical. No, they're not. And the differences are as important as the considerable things they have in common. If you will, think of it this way. The fourth commandment itself is already a covenant historically located expression of a more fundamental reality about God in relationship to his people and creation. The fourth commandment is already an expression of something beyond itself and deeper than itself. And we can call that deeper reality the Sabbath idea or the Sabbath principle that the fourth commandment becomes an expression of. This is why, for instance, the fourth commandment in Exodus has a different given provided ground or rationale from the fourth commandment given in Deuteronomy. Did you know that? Compare the two decalogues and you'll see Exodus gives one rationale for it. Deuteronomy gives a different rationale for it. Are they competing? No. In their different covenant historical locations, they are expressing that more fundamental Sabbath idea or principle in ways that fit the concerns of Exodus as a whole, Deuteronomy as a whole, but also the place Israel is in that covenantal history. The Lord's Day is a further and deeper and more robust covenant historical expression of the Sabbath principle. So is the Lord's Day the Old Testament Sabbath? No, most obviously because it's not on Saturday, the seventh day of the week. There's our first great signal, something different has happened. Is it reflective of the Sabbath principle? Absolutely so, which is why they meet unfailingly, the early Christians do, on the first day of the week and do Sabbath things, if you will. But in the New Covenant order. So we're not going to collapse one into the other as though they are identical, although we also need to avoid the temptation to underestimate the significant continuities between them. But that continuity is along the lines of a Sabbath principle, a Sabbath idea, which we also want to say is not the thin, harsh, and legalistic, in one way that term is used, legalistic practice of negation that Sabbatarianism has often been in Christian homes for about a century now. Ever since approximately late 19th century into early 20th century, up through just before then, and then for a little while after World War II, major cultural shifts were taking place in the West that involved a deepening rift between two different ways of looking at human meaning, meaning of society, the meaning of life, the difference between them becoming more and more pronounced over time. One of those trajectories did include, within Christian circles, and especially Reformed ones, but not only Reformed circles, an almost, we'll say a mixed, a varied way of relating positively to select features of the Puritan Sabbath tradition, especially in Scotland. I say select because it wasn't wholesale and because it wasn't always historically informed. There were also some Sabbatarian practices inherited from the continent, but most of them came from the Puritan context. On the other trajectory, the opposite trajectory from this, was within and outside of nominal Christian circles, a revolt or reaction to the cultural conditions that created the possibility of the First World War. This became that much more pronounced, of course, after World War II. And the horrors of World War II provoked that much more of a desire along the lines of that trajectory to react to the assumed cultural principles which gave rise to it as a possibility. But again, this general cultural atmosphere found two different expressions along the lines of these two trajectories. After World War II, particularly in America, the shell of Christianity was retained in the general culture, whereas the core was eclipsed and lost. In that trajectory that had older roots in kind of Puritan ways of looking at piety and especially Sabbatarianism, it became, in American culture after World War II, and we're thinking now through the 50s and into the 60s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, it became the Christianity which was indistinguishable from Americanism. And it became the wholesome model of family life, represented in some of the classic sitcoms, of course, My Three Sons and Leave It to Beaver and things like that sort. These were designed to communicate a model of the nominally culturally Christian America that, in fact, had nothing whatsoever to do with Christianity, but was utterly moral. That moralism fed into a vulnerability in American culture toward legalism, so that within these nominal Christian homes, you might have very, very hard rules along the lines of negation of what could or could not be done on Sundays. And culturally, you had the remnants of older models along the lines of prohibition, although that eventually collapsed. And then the blue laws, especially when it came to the Lord's Day, where there was a general cultural morality, but the Christian core of it was less and less a meaningful part of that picture. Until you have the sitcom model of wholeness, which on the one hand did very little justice to the realities of life in the world as sinners know it, but on the other hand communicated that morality was the same as Christianity. And so Christian families, especially with the rise of certain family-oriented organizations and evangelicalism, they were modeling a good Christian family on what Americana had suggested a moral family would look like, which became extremely dangerous for perpetuating distinctively Christian content in any of these contexts, because it looked so similar to what we would think Christianity would look like, but was utterly empty of its heart, of its truth content. What's also interesting about this growing trajectory is how when you reach the 60s and then it pushed into the 70s, the other trajectory on this front, the one that was revolting against culture, took the form, typically, of resistance mentalities. And so you had, as everybody knows, the triumph publicly and culturally of protest movements and a protest mentality and a resistance mentality. And what are they protesting and resisting? Well, largely the world that made World War II possible, yes, but also the world that came out of that. The Leave It to Beaver world, the My Three Sons world, which they were protesting as fictions, as not doing justice to real life, as not doing justice to oppression and the plight of the poor, the plight of the marginalized, the plight of the financial world generally, with gross inequities that are rooted in injustices and so forth, and greed and the like, and the need for a political revolution. Of course, the roots are complex, but it's a reaction to the sitcom world's inability to cash out on its promises, to fulfill on its promises. In many ways, as historians have noted, the 60s were only possible because of the Americana of the 40s and 50s, although this is not usually how they are connected among those who prefer the 40s and 50s and that Americana world. Now, this is where the biblical Sabbath comes in as an idea. And in a most stunning and compelling way, says in its own way, a pox on all your houses. It is neither the Sabbatarianism of the moralistic Americana of earlier generations that was empty of Christian content, but nor is it identifiable with the protest movements of the 60s and 70s. Now, this is particularly important for us to think about today, because we have a responsibility, and the Sabbath reminds us of this, a responsibility to love our neighbors, even in how we think about who the church is as a Sabbath people. I was reminded of this at the musical theater drama camp my girls and Ruby were at in the last couple of weeks, and they had their performance on Thursday and Friday, and I went to the one on Friday. And this was at Geneva College, and they did a fantastic job. It was really remarkably well done with almost no time to prepare. They pulled off a miracle of a performance. And it was amazing. But what they did was they collected a number of musical numbers, and they joined them together into a series, one performance with an intermission in between. What I found really interesting is how many of the selections, and particularly it was Elisa's group that was the great picture of this, the emblem of this, were expressive of that, of the contemporary version of the 60s and 70s protest movements. In our day, of course, what's the most popular musical being discussed by anybody under the age of 21? It's the musical Hamilton, yes, Hamilton. And the story of the American Revolution being told by the Hamilton musical is without doubt a 21st century version of the very same things being said and done in the 60s and early 70s along protest cultural movements. It's the return of the protest mentality as a way of reading the American Revolution they were protesting. And now it's grippingly done. It's amazingly done. It's extraordinarily done. But in its spirit, it's interesting and important to note the commonalities that we are, as it were, making our way around that circle again culturally. What goes hand in hand with a protest mentality and a resistance mentality, however, is an assumption that's more wholesale about the order that comes before. A critical relationship to everything that comes before. And when this appeals to those in their, especially in the years of adolescence, when they're for the first time in their lives exploring the world outside of their domestic situation, outside their family, their home, what's most familiar to them, it's of course most appealing to them in that time of vulnerability to adopt a wholesale mentality about what came before. Everything about what was before is wrong. Anything that's going to be worthwhile will have to be new. Now, our kids don't buy into that, thankfully, but that is a reality culturally that finds expression in a variety of these protest movement expressions. Now, what does this have to do with the Sabbath? Well, maybe surprisingly, the idea of resistance is key to biblical Sabbatarianism. Instead of relating to our young people along the purely negative lines about the attractiveness of a protest mentality and a resistance mentality and a critical relationship to the world around them, the Christian and the Christian faith is alone able to do full justice to the good that often comes through that kind of critical relationship and posture. Loving our neighbors, beginning with our own children who are growing up in our homes and thinking through these things themselves, loving our neighbors begins with loving them with a listening ear and noting the ways in which the gospel, which has a Sabbath core to it, it can be most meaningful and most compelling for them on their own terms already. And seeing how the Sabbath is in fact an act of weekly resistance rather than just negation, passivity, not doing 50,000 things and doing this one thing of going to church, right? Instead of thinking that way, thinking biblically about what the Sabbath really is and why it is what it is along the lines of resistance can be spiritually fruitful for our young people, but for every one of us as well, in recovering the beauty of a Sabbatarian principle. I think maybe the darkest tragedy of the Sabbath in relationship to maybe the last few generations is the frequency with which Christian parents have struggled mightily on this front, with the result that they end up crushing covenant children with the negations that the Sabbath does bring into view, as communicating a false image of the Sabbath as though it is a matter of negation, when that is completely backwards. What the Sabbath proscribes, that is, keeps you from doing, is informed not directly, but indirectly. What the Sabbath informs directly are positives, positive forms of resistance, positive forms of alternatives that belong to who we really are as the church. And as those positives are pursued meaningfully and intelligently, the things negated find their way naturally around that periphery. So when we adopt the mindset instead of the Sabbath as negating, we not only get it wrong, as it were, academically or theologically, we get it wrong in a destructive way for the Sabbatarian faith of that child for years to come. Again, this is what yielded the protest movements, was a thin, empty notion of morality that was lacking its gospel and Christian core. We need to treat the Sabbath as a case study of that and make sure we don't fall prey to treating the Sabbath principle as a matter of mere morality and lose its Christian core. The negations that are there in Sabbath practice are there indirectly. The positives regarding both resistance and its alternatives are there directly. Now, the way that we'll explore this in the weeks to come is along these six lines that begin with the first commandment. I found a book by Walter Brueggemann, a very small book, by Walter Brueggemann, a critical liberal Old Testament scholar, often very thoughtful in dealing with the Sabbath question. In fact, he's the one who gives us our language of the Sabbath as resistance. That's the title of his little book. And he develops how it's both resistance and alternative. I will differ from him very, very much along the way, but I'll use the structure of his brief discussion as our structure as well. So note what it means for the Sabbath to be an issue of resistance. You'll have to trust me over here, Rachel. I'm reading what it says. First of all, we frame our relationship to Sabbatarianism as an idea by relating it firstly to the first commandment, to the God of the first commandment, in fact, to the God of the first three commandments, because the fourth commandment is a hinge from what's true about God, and then also how to love your neighbor. The Sabbath is an important hinge there. So first of all, the Sabbath idea and the first commandment, and then these four ways that in our world, in our culture, in our context, we need the good news of the Sabbath as resistance, as protest, active protest in the form of resistance. Resistance to anxiety. These are all biblically rooted ways the Sabbath functions as resistance. Resistance to anxiety. We'll look at Exodus 20, verses 12 to 17. Resistance to coercion. Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 to 14. Resistance to exclusivism, Isaiah 56, verses 3 to 8. And then resistance to multitasking, Amos chapter 8, verses 4 through 8. And every mother says, is there any other life than the multitasking one? But we'll explain what that means and what it doesn't. Then we'll finish by looking at the Sabbath in relationship to the last of the commandments, the 10th commandment. Now, any questions on what we've said so far before we decide if we have a minute or two to start thinking about our topic? Any questions so far? Yes, Mr. Howard.
Earlier you talked about the therapeutic culture and
yeah.
Counseling and
yes.
Responsibilities.
Yes.
Do Reformed seminaries, you think they've bought into that a little bit in what they offer, and they're, or are they pretty balanced? In, have they, maybe a lot of seminaries, focus a lot on the counseling aspect? What about Reformed seminaries?
That's a very good question. I'd hate to paint Reformed seminaries with a broad brush. But I can say some do better than others with this. And the place it comes through is in the seminary's so-called practical theology department. The practical theology courses required for a Master's of Divinity program, the traditional 3 to 4 year program for ministers. The way it comes through is in what the content is of those pastoral theology courses, where the focus is, where the weight of gravity is, weight of emphasis is. Why? Well, they should all Reformed seminaries, confessional Reformed seminaries certainly, should within their practical theology departments include extensive study and coursework in the history, but also biblical roots and contemporary questions related to liturgy, with worship generally, liturgy as a subspecies of worship generally, preaching, leading in worship, prayer. They should also include evangelism, missions, church government, right? But then they should also include, distinct from those, theological anthropology applied, which is how we should think of pastoral counseling. The mind-body problem in relationship to pastoral counseling for those using strong medications, psychotherapeutic drugs, things like that, for various needs. A pastor's ability to read those situations well requires some solid education, or you can bring more harm than good. Other forms, marriage and family issues, divorce theory, all that needs to be part of a practical theology curriculum. But I'll tell you what's often the case, is that a pastoral theology curriculum is almost entirely counseling, maybe some general marriage and family stuff, or evangelism, missiology in a missional, more contemporary sense, and maybe a hat tip toward matters of church government, and almost nothing meaningful about what happens every Lord's Day. A preaching class or two for sure, but almost entirely driven by practices, strategies, how to relate illustrations to bullet points, what's most compelling for an audience, reading the world around you. That's the preaching course. Now, I'm being unfair to some Reformed seminaries, but I'm also describing other Reformed seminaries, I think, faithfully. And so it is a challenge that we have out there, and the situation is varied. So some are doing it well, some are not. I think the ones that aren't doing it very well are taking a valid concern that ministers be able to do solid pastoral counseling, a solid, legitimate, important concern, and making it everything, or close to it. Yeah. Yeah, Dave. We talked about that our first week, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the full formula.
Moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Moralistic, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, didn't he describe that was the majority of young people
yeah.
that sort of buy into that view of God?
That's right. That's what we did our first week was he looked at that. Yeah. So that set us up for this. That's exactly right. And they had a later book that was published some years later, 10 years later, about young adults. Along those lines, to kind of follow the same research group later and see where they were. Falls out very much along those lines, too. So, yeah. Doug? Yes? Oh, no, you had a question.
No, I just thought.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. The Smith and Lundquist Denton books were helpful. Yeah, Dave?
You talked about the positive principles of
sanitarianism. Yeah. It does. It is easier. Yeah.
But, I mean, you're not saying that there should be, it seems to me there should be these things you should say to your children, you should not do this, not this,
yeah.
not do this, that.
Yep.
But you're saying that that should flow from the positive.
Exactly. Yes, they don't have an independent status. The negations, the negatives, they don't have an independent existence. They are what they are only because of what's true positively about the Sabbath. But yes, we have to help our children think along those lines, think with the grain of the positives by noting what the negations are. But in the way that we think about it, and yes, in the way that we do that, even in what we think those negations are, we may have our thinking challenged about what they exactly are. They need to be controlled by how the Bible deals with the Sabbath idea, which is along the lines of it as a gift. And what it is for as a gift, what its purpose is as a gift, how that gift finds expression by giving us relief from these various things that we wrestle with now more than ever, but which are very, very old concerns. We'll see how it starts with Exodus. And Pharaoh and Egypt are, in fact, images of these very problems that we continue to deal with. And the Sabbath continues to function as a principle in giving us relief from these things. Well, what does it look like to be relieved of them? Well, it means not buying into the way the world thinks we have to be entertained, we have to be gratified, we need to be busy working and producing, and if you're not producing, you're not meaningful. These are some of the things that we think through. And they create negations. They create negatives. But here is our orientation. Yeah. Yeah. Some coffee there, Lisa. All right, I think that's enough for this morning to give us a bit of time to transition to our morning service. But maybe you can think about this series and your prayers for the church throughout the week as we start making our way in earnest through these subject areas and these questions, and pray that the Sabbath facet of the gospel will bring refreshment to our church and give us a renewed sense of energetic identity along these lines too. All right, thank you for your attention this morning.